We don't yet have a quorum, but we're going to get started. I'm going to call to order the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Today is Thursday, March 14th. As soon as we get a quorum, we will start with some of the shorter bills. But Representative Moline is going to start with House File 892, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act updated. And Representative Moline, please just focus on the areas that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing House File 892, which is the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. What this does, members, is, as some of you will recall, we sometimes pass individual bills when we're trying to collect child support orders internationally. Last year, if you'll recall, Representative Hoppe had a bill because he had a constituent whose ex-husband had moved to Bermuda, so we had to pass a special bill in order to try to get Bermuda to enforce Minnesota's child support order. This bill is going to make that easier so that we aren't, you know, having to pass bills for one person for one country. So with me I have Judge Harriet Lansing, who will be able to much better explain the bill, and I want to thank her. She's been sitting here since 3:30, so I'm sure she's very well prepared. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. If I could just interrupt for 1 second. Members, there's a little bit of pizza left over. If you want to take some that represent Lesh is bringing up to the table, members, you can help yourself. But welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go
ahead.
Thank
you, Chair Hillstrom. I'm Harriet Lansing. I'm here on behalf of the Uniform Minnesota Commissioners for the Uniform Law Commission. I'm prepared to say as much about the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act as is useful for you to hear, but I recognize from my own experience that some of these subdivisions might interest in them may exceed the interests of other people. So I'm just going to give you a quick overview, and then I'm going to focus on the issues that I think relate to the question of any fiscal note, if that seems like an appropriate way to proceed. I would just say that we would urge passage of this because House File 892 improves international recognition and enforcement of child support orders. It clarifies existing law. And this seems to be an appropriate time to go forward on this because we have in place the we're trying to keep in place the continued collection of federal child support funds that is required, and that enacting House File 892 within the required time period will do that. Minnesota's authority regarding child support issues will be preserved by this act, and we think that we're in a position to act now because necessary changes have been worked through. The Minnesota State Bar Association and the American Bar Association endorsed the act, and the delayed effective date will align with federal legislation. I would say that there is a fiscal note on this item. I understand that the Department of Human Services computes a fiscal note on staff time and computer work, and that is what it is for. I don't believe that this amount would diminish over a period of time. It might actually increase, so I think that it probably works better to do it now, and it may in fact be better to do it now rather than later because the department is considering updates to their computer system, and if they have this lead time, they may be able to integrate it in such a way that the cost will be reduced or nearly eliminated. So that's my presentation. Thank you, Representative Moline.
Representative Moline, is this bill have to go somewhere else?
Madam Chair, I wasn't aware of that, and we don't have a fiscal note. I wasn't aware that there was any fiscal impact. So.
Representative Moline, we need to run upstairs and confirm one way or another, but why don't I take any public testimony that there is and any questions that there might be, because if there's a fiscal note, it's got to go to whatever fiscal committee has the fiscal note, or it needs to go to Ways and Means. So, Representative Scott, we can wait. I can ask someone else if you want.
That's what I was going to ask, is where is the fiscal note? If there is one, I was looking through my packet. So,
Representative Scott, we didn't know that there was one, so fiscal staff just went upstairs to check.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none. Any further testimony you wanted to give, Representative Moline, or your testifier?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, we officially have a quorum, so I'll officially call this meeting to order. And members, while we wait on the fiscal information, I'm just going to lay the bill over. Thank you, Representative Moline. All right, the next item we're going to take up is Representative Freiberg's House File 1120. Representative Freiberg, welcome to the committee. The chair moves that House File 1120 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is a non-controversial bill that's already been heard in the Government Operations Committee, where we spent about 2 minutes discussing it before sending it over to this committee. I mistakenly informed my testifier, Judge Lippman, of the Office of Administrative Hearings that he was determined to come back to this, but I said, I think it probably will be much later. So he's not here at the moment. He had some handouts. I have one here with some notes if it's helpful. But basically what the bill does is right now under current law, the ALJ approves two different kinds of or makes decisions in certain kinds of cases, and then in those cases, the ALJ's office themselves is actually named as a party in any appeal, so they receive the appeal documents and those sorts of things. But in other types of decisions on this chart here, and there's examples of them, which I'm happy to read to you, the ALJ makes a recommendation, and then the agency head issues the final decision. And in those cases, the agency head is the one who has served which actually has a policy interest in the outcome of the decision. So it is the agency that's the party. So this just makes it clear that it's the party in interest, typically the agency that is actually going to be served the documents in the appeal. I heard Judge Lippman, I believe he said that it's a little bit unseemly for a judge to be a party in a case trying to argue in an appeal that, no, I was really right. So this just clarifies law, puts it in a more, makes it more appropriate. I'm happy to answer questions to the best of my ability.
Questions from members. Just to be clear, this is an agency bill, is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, Office of Administrative Hearings.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Just answered my question.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 1120 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you.
Representative Simon, are you still in the room? Representative Simon, I think your bill is not controversial at all. So let's just quick take your bill. The chair moves that House File 1043 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1043 strengthens the penalties that we have now related to false and phony 911 calls. And this really is an issue in a lot of jurisdictions. In the state of Louisiana, just last Friday, for example, their statewide police issued a bulletin to all law enforcement. I have here, I don't have it as a handout, talking about what a problem this has been. California also has experienced this problem in several major metropolitan areas with people calling and doing kind of fake 911 calls. That alone obviously is a problem. But what's really a problem is when people get hurt because of it and suffer serious bodily injury or even death. And so what the bill does, as you can read for yourself, is it ups the penalty, particularly in instances where one of the first responders or someone else suffers harm or ultimately even death. So that's the bill. It's supported, I might add, by a number of organizations, including the Sheriff's Association, the Minnesota Police Chiefs, and the Minnesota Ambulance Association. The language in here mirrors similar language that was passed a number of years ago, I think in 2003, regarding penalties for armor. And so that is the bill. It passed with no audible dissent in the last committee, and this is its last stop. And there's no fiscal note that I know of.
Questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson
Representative.
First.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Johnson first, then. Sorry. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon. I'm just wondering if this bill deals with nuisance calls as well. I have a situation in my area. Current exchange is 689, and they ran out of numbers, so they added 691. And I've been in my office, my former office now, many times, in the sheriff's office and the dispatch center, and they added a new prefix of 691, and it seems like half the time when people call a 6911 plus some other number, it ends up going to the 911 calls. So we get 50 to 60 nuisance calls a day just because of the prefix issue.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, actually, fortunately or unfortunately, this bill would not cover that. It only covers those who knowingly call, knowing that there's no public service emergency or public safety emergency, with the purpose of interfering or throwing people kind of off the scent. That's what's happened in other states. Is there's some criminal elements who apparently call 911, particularly in jurisdictions where they know it's a smaller jurisdiction, and they figure they'll create a diversion by making a phony 911 call. Meanwhile, they're creating mischief in some other area of town. So it wouldn't do that. And by the way, interestingly, and some members who have served here for a while remember, the reason that we now dial in our Capitol phones here 8 first and not 9 is that was happening here. There were people who accidentally somehow were dialing 9 to dial out, and I don't know how many phone numbers begin with 1-1, but apparently that was happening. And so 2-3 years ago, I lost track, we changed to dialing 8 for that very reason, but this would not cover it.
Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, is there a problem in Minnesota with false 911 calls?
Representative Simon.
Representative McNamer, good question. Yes, apparently there is, and there was a recent episode in Oakdale, not too far from here from the Capitol recently, where there was a call that they tried to trace, and there's a strong suspicion that was false, and there were some complications there. So that's just one recent episode, but yes, it has been a problem, apparently.
Representative Johnson. Any other questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wish to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 1043 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simon.
Thank you, members.
Okay, Representative Newton. Representative McNamer, do you want to move Representative Newton's bill?
Madam Chair, I move that we move on Newton's bill. Representative Newton?
No. Yep, correct.
Okay.
To State Government Finance and Military Affairs. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Welcome to the committee. Sorry. Representative
you,
Newton,
Chair.
Please go ahead.
This bill is an agency bill for the Department of Military Affairs. With me today, I have Mr. Don Kerr from the department and Major Lindsay Olson, who's the JAG officer with the military. The portion of this bill, I believe, that your committee would be concerned with is on pages 11 and 12, and it has to do with the appellate court. It provides that the bill, let me review the bill quickly. What we're doing here is bringing the state Minnesota Code of Military Justice in line with the Universal Code of Uniform Code of Military Justice of the federal government. And the one change that we have that seems to affect your committee has to do with the appellate court. Currently, military courts martials and affairs dealing with crime in the military go through a chain of command, and it stopped at the highest ranking person in the chain of command. This bill provides that it would also go to the military court of appeal if the person that's been convicted of a crime wishes to appeal the sentence of the court.
And to your testifiers, Representative Newton. Are they here to answer questions or to?
Yes, they're here to answer questions if we have any.
Okay, questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative McNamer renews his motion that House File 1138 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Finance, and Veterans Affairs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Newton.
We're going to do Representative Moline. Members, we're going to pull Representative Moline's bill off the table that I laid over. It's my understanding that there may be a fiscal note for the Department of Human Services, Health and Human Services, and so we're going to send it there. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize, members. I didn't know that there was a fiscal impact, but DHS is telling me that there will be a minimal fiscal impact, so I'd like to move House File 892 be recommended to pass and sent to Health and Human Services, Finance.
Representative Moline amends her motion and makes it House File 892 be recommended to pass and be sent to the HHS Finance Committee. Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Moline. Okay, Representative Hansen, are you here? Welcome to the committee, Representative Hansen. Members, Representative Hansen's bill was already heard by us. Representative Drazkowski raised an issue, and there was an agreement to lay the bill over to put together an amendment. There's going to be an amendment offered, and then once that amendment is offered, it's my understanding that now it needs to go to the Committee on State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs. So
that is correct.
Representative Hansen, why don't you go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have with me Mr. Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board, and thinking back 2 weeks ago, we talked about how do we connect the judicial standards and the public official so we're not duplicating efforts. And Mr. Goldsmith has drafted an amendment for us, and we'll walk through it.
Briefly walk through the amendment. Mr. Goldstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The board had two concerns with the bill. One is that it did not want to get into the position of having to make decisions on whether judges should have recused themselves from particular cases or particular rulings. The board believed that those decisions should remain with the Board of Judicial Standards where they are now. Secondly, the board had a concern because judges already file a type of financial statement with the court commissioner under the rules for judges, and this would require a second filing of financial interests by judges with the Campaign Finance Board, although that filing would be more encompassing than the one that they file with the commissioner. And Representative Drazkowski asked if we could provide the disclosure so that we could do that and publish it on our website and yet not have to make the decisions about whether a judge had a conflict of interest in a case where that judge was sitting. And I said, of course, we could do that. And so that's what this amendment does, and I will go through it quickly. Section 1 of the amendment is the same as the bill. This is a delete everything. And so it adds judges, justices, and county commissioners to the list of public officials, which means they are covered by the gift ban, and they also have to file statements of economic interest with the board. Section 2 of the original bill is stricken. The effect of that is that judges will file their economic interest statements when they are elected or appointed rather than when they file to run for office. They're not public officials at the time they file to run for office, and the board's position, at least on adding new public officials, is that unless you believe that financial disclosure should be a criteria for voters in deciding whether to vote for somebody or not, that disclosure should come after they become public officials. So judges would file statements of economic interest with the board within 60 days after appointment or their first day of service in office. In the amendment, Section 2 is the provision that requires most public officials to file a notice of a conflict of interest with the head of the body in which they serve. Judges would be exempt from that section because they're covered for conflicts of interest by the Code of Judicial Conduct and the Board of Judicial Standards. Section three of the amendment. Excuse Excuse me, Madam Chair. Section 3 of the amendment relates to the definition of official in the gift ban. Because judges will now be public officials, it's not necessary to list them separately as judges. It would be a duplication, and we try to avoid duplication. So it has no effect on who is covered by the gift ban. Section 4 exempts judges from filing statements of representation disclosure with the Campaign Finance Board. Actually, under the Code of Judicial Conduct, they're prohibited from representing others before agencies and boards. And Section 5 doesn't change the effect of the original bill. It just changes the way it was worded. Local officials file with their local units of government. Public officials file with the board. There was a question about county commissioners and metropolitan governmental units. They would be both local and public officials. They would file two places. The original bill exempted them from the definition of local official, but they are local officials. So the last sentence in subdivision 6A and section 5 of the bill just makes it clear that if you're both, you file with the Campaign Finance Board. And this bill would be effective for people either taking office or being appointed to position after January 1, 2014.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? No. The chair then moves the A13 amendment to House File 136. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. So the chair renews her motion that House File 136 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on State Government, Finance, and Veterans Affairs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Members, Representative Cornish, do you care if I take you last?
Yeah.
Okay. Members, we're going to have Representative Dean, come forward on House File 1031. Members, we're going to have a 10 minutes hearing on this, and then the chair is going to lay this bill over. So welcome to the committee. Please go ahead with House File 1031.
Okay, before we get started, I have one slight change, an oral amendment on line 121. I believe it's the eighth word in. Change that from 2 years to 4 years. So the two changes to a four.
Any questions from members? Any objections to that as an amendment? All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill before you this evening looks at issues related to life insurance policies after they've been issued. And it has two sections, but I will go directly to Section 2, which I believe is under the purview of the committee. It deals with situations where a life insurer refuses to say whether it will not contest the validity of a policy, and in this situation, Section 2 gives the policyholder the right to sue the insurer to seek a court decision as to whether the policy is valid and award court costs and attorney fees to the insured if the court decides the policy is valid. I have testifiers here today, and we will try to get through them in about 4.5 minutes.
Perfect. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of a company called Fortress. And Fortress has taken the lead nationally in a growing problem in that that deals with life insurance, and that is namely the wrong denials of life insurance from policies sold by Minnesota consumers. And life insurance, just so members know, is property like anything else. Your car, you can sell it under certain legal conditions. And Minnesota has affirmed our right to sell our life insurance policies by the passage of the Insurable Trust or Insurable Interest Act in 2009, which covers the legal sale of your policy and it governs fraudulent policies and is in an effort to prevent them from happening. And we certainly support that provision, and no one wants a fraudulent policy. They call them STOLI, stranger originated, where you don't have an interest in the person when the policy is initiated. Those are not good for Minnesota consumers. We do not support them, but we do support the legal right of consumers to sell their policy to a third party within their legal rights. And that's what the focus of Section 2 is of this bill. Currently in Minnesota law, there is no judicial remedy, none, for a consumer or a policyholder to bring an action in court to have a policy affirmed. And this used to not be a problem. According to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the denial of life insurance policies was at a rate of about 0.5%, a very small rate. It was so small, in fact, that Minnesota exempted life insurance companies from our insurance conduct standards in 604A.18. I handed it to the committee, just so you know. The remedies that other consumers have to enforce their rights when a company doesn't deal with them on a reasonable basis does not apply to life insurance, and that's why we're here. That's what has changed, Madam Chair and members, is that we have now seen a significant spike in denial of claims, particularly on policies that have been legally sold, where now the NAIC and corporate records indicate that the denial rates run between 3% and 5% in some cases, and the highest one I could find was up to 20% denial rates of legally sold policies. And owners of policies have attempted to rectify this problem by seeking verification of coverage from insurance companies. And they have done so, unfortunately, without success. I provided a copy of a verification denial letter from a company, and they simply state that they're not going to provide the verification of coverage because Minnesota law does not require it. This is that law. Section 2 is that law that would require an insurance company 4 years after they have been collecting premiums from a policyholder to verify that its coverage is in existence. That's all Section 2 does. It does not encourage fraud. It does not promote STOLI. It does not provide a windfall to anyone. It simply allows a policyholder to verify the existence of its coverage. And it protects consumers and individuals, because without a market to sell your insurance, you don't have anything. You just can surrender it to the insurance company or let it lapse. So, Madam Chair and members, you know, when we heard this bill on Tuesday night in Commerce, I kind of felt some of your pain, because it felt like a campaign put on by a PR firm. We heard about hedge fund bailouts and East Coast funds. You know, Fortress is neither a hedge fund nor does it need a bailout. Being accused of seeking a bailout from the insurance industry is an amazing spin, and we all remember an $800 billion AIG bailout. But that is not what is at place here. Madam Chair, all Section 2 does is provides a remedy to enforce our contractual rights, and we appreciate you taking the time to listen to it, and that is all that we're asking. So, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, I hope you will at some point give this consideration, because it is a growing problem, and the problem for the courts is that if you have to go to court to affirm your policy when they won't pay, at the rate that they're going, you are going to add between 2,500 and 3,000 cases a year to our court system, which is equal to, or just about equal to, the entire personal injury filing in our state right now, which has about 3,300. So it has an impact on the court unless we can provide a remedy for individuals to verify that policy up front. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. James Clark with Messaline Kramer. I think Mr. Carlson left me about 30 seconds, so I will try to stay within that. Madam Chair, I am appearing here on behalf of ILMA, the Institutional Longevity Markets Association. ILMA is a trade association comprised of a number of the world's leading institutions in the life settlement marketplace, including Minnesota companies such as Wells Fargo, Wilmington Trust, 21st Services, and other companies such as Credit Suisse, Fortress, McKinsey, and other leading institutions. ILMA members seek to educate consumers about the value of their life insurance asset, expand consumer choice in life insurance, and support the responsible growth and regulations of the life settlement industry. Madam Chair, I'll be very, very brief. As I said, we thank you for the opportunity to appear today in strong support of HF 1031.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? I have a few people who have signed up ahead of time, so if you'd like to, come on down. Keep in mind that we're going to just be laying the bill over today. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MFSI. MFSI represents our domestic life insurance and financial services industry. We have about 65,000 jobs in the state, including all of the agents that distribute our products in every corner of Minnesota. I want to be very clear about something. This bill is not a consumer rights bill. This bill is about an institutional investor or hedge fund rights bill. And it absolutely is about STOLI. For those of you who may not be familiar with it, STOLI, not the vodka, is it what happens when a stranger induces a senior to go out and purchase a policy for the sole purpose, not of protecting their loved ones, but selling it back to institutional investors. And STOLI policies are always fraudulent policies. You can't have STOLI without fraud. Courts have considered those policies void as wagers on human life since like the 1700s in 10 minutes. I won't go through the history of that. But I think the public policy there is obvious. You have to have an insurable interest on someone on whom you take out a life insurance policy. Watch a crime show, it's the first question they ask, who's got the life insurance policy? Who's the beneficiary? To demonstrate the fact that this is not about consumers trying to get their policies paid by life insurance companies, and the rate for the industry is 0.05%. So we pay them very promptly. If you look at Section 2 of the legislation, it talks about they're just not asking if we'll pay or if the policy is valid. They're asking if we're going to contest it for lack of an insurable interest. We have to go to court to do that. We don't get to do that on our own. They don't let us declare policies void unless we have a court determination. But the only reason you declare a policy void for lack of insurable interest is if it's a STOLI policy. So if you're talking about your grandmother's life insurance policy, she's never going to call their life insurance company and ask for a verification of whether her policy is going to be challenged for insurable interest because the life insurance policy is on her husband or the kids have it on the parents. But it's an insurable interest is very, very obvious. What this bill does in its entirety is basically gut the strong STOLI, anti-STOLI law that we passed back in 2009. That was a Kate Knuth bill. Every state that has looked at this legislation thus far has rejected it. And basically what it does is it makes fraudulent STOLI policies a risk-free investment, and it does that in two ways. What the bill does is require that the court, if the court finds a policy to be void for lack of insurable interest or a fraudulent insurance or fraudulent STOLI transaction, what this bill says is that the court has to return the premiums back to the investor, and not just the premiums they paid, but the premiums that everyone paid plus 10% interest. So if you think about it, basically it makes STOLI an absolutely risk-free investment because you can't lose. Either the insurance company never finds the fraud and you get the death benefit, or you get all your premiums back. And by making STOLI a risk-free investment, you are simply going to encourage STOLI promoters to go out and recruit more seniors to commit STOLI schemes, and that's against public policy. One more quick point before I eat up all of our time. It would also overturn Minnesota case law. In 2010, a Minnesota court in the Morello decision allowed the insurance company in a STOLI case to keep the premium rather than returning it to the investor, stating that to do otherwise would only incent fraud. And that's because if you can't lose, there's no reason not to give it a try.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. I'm Michael Lewandowski, representing the American Council of Life Insurers. Thank you for just a few minutes this afternoon. The ACLI represents 256 companies doing business in the state. Some of our members are members of the local domestic trade association. some may not be. Our companies do generate about 53,000 jobs in the state, and those constituents and those companies are very interested in what you're going to do with this bill, because it very much addresses important operations in each of the insurance companies, and it could very well affect the ability of the companies to do a viable business in the state. I've been asked to answer the question as to whether this legislation will, the failure to enact this legislation will negatively impact the life settlement market. There's two answers to that question. One of them is we all have to hope that the answer is absolutely no, because if Fortress is informing us that the life settlement market is so contaminated with illegal policies that would by operation of law be void or void ab initio or invalidated, that is a horrendous piece of information that is being laid before us, and I would encourage someone to investigate whether that could possibly be true. The HLI has no reason to believe that's true. Certainly the representatives of the secondary market itself would not agree that that most of the transactions that their settlement providers and brokers engage in are somehow potentially invalidated or vulnerable to avoid invalidated by some kind of operation of law. So there's no empirical reason to believe that this could possibly be true. In fact, I would submit to you that the opposite is true, that the enactment of this piece of legislation would endanger the secondary market because it would insulate the worst kinds of transactions within the secondary market, things that might be result in invalidated contracts, stranger originated life insurance, or other kinds of problems with the policies. And certainly the kinds of restrictions that are proposed in Section 2 with regard to verifications of coverage would be a huge monkey wrench into the traditional operation of your insurance companies in this state. Verifications of coverage are something that every insurance company in this nation provides as a matter of routine to the owners of the policies or to their rightfully designated and authorized representatives. If Fortress has a problem getting a verification of coverage, it's because there's some flaw in the chain of custody with regard to the ownership of that policy itself. It's a purely administrative thing, and the thing that a verification of coverage establishes is that there is a policy in existence and that the premiums have been paid up on it. What Fortress would propose you do in this legislation is make it a sort of an existential test, not of whether the policy is in existence, but rather to look into the future and conduct all of the investigations which are normally a part of the claims process, and then be able to assert with confidence that there wouldn't be a claim denial when the claim was actually made. That is a completely radical concept. It is nowhere found anywhere in this country. It would be extremely disruptive to the traditional business of insurance in the state if the Section 2 was enacted. This legislation is remarkable in many other ways. I mean, I don't know. I'm not from Minnesota, but I very seldom see legislation that would actually articulate and institutionalize special interest rights as a matter of codified law. And yet in this two-page bill, there is the establishment of at least two rights. The right in the second section is especially interesting in the sense that you would actually be purporting to command a right to a judicial declaration. Now, my understanding is that your judiciary is an independent judiciary. And as an independent judiciary, it might think that a bit of its job is being taken away by a command that any special interest investor can walk into a court and command the right to a judicial determination.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. Well, just one other observation then. With regard to the other right, it has to do with the possibility that illegal contracts would enjoy a 100% return of premium. I urge you to make a note that in the very first line of this bill, it's not just a kind of invalidation. It's policies deemed to be void. That's one kind. Policies deemed to be void ab initio. That's another. Policies deemed to be otherwise terminated in accordance with law. And the fourth kind are policies extinguished in accordance with law.
Thank you for your testimony. The last two people that were on the agenda that wanted to speak were Peter Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce and Tim Vanda High, Deputy Commissioner of Insurance. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And keep in mind that this is the Judiciary Committee, so if you could talk about the judicial piece.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs. In the interest of time, I will turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Van de Hey.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Tim Van de Hey. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Commerce from the Insurance Division, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak. As is the standard practice of Commerce when reviewing proposed legislation, we focus predominantly on the potential impact of consumers and whether it may be clearly identified that consumers could be harmed by the proposal before we take a position. Identifying impact to consumers of this legislation is difficult, as typically the consumer is in large part no longer engaged at the point in time that this legislation would be pertinent. However, some have expressed concerns that sophisticated schemers of stranger originated life insurance policies, STOLI, might be emboldened if a return of premiums at interest is uniformly applied to the secondary market, regardless of the potential fraud at origination of the policies. The attractiveness of these securities to the secondary market would certainly be heightened on passage. Currently, we are not aware of consumers having difficulty legitimately selling their life insurance settlement. On the other side, some would suggest that insurers should do a more adequate job of underwriting to detect this fraud at origination. However, they often downplay the difficulty of insurers having to implement underwriting standards stringent enough that would detect potential collusion by the original parties at the origination of the policy. It is important to keep in mind that these are two sophisticated industries that we are discussing that have the ability to seek legal remedy and vigorously defend their own interests. The transactions are complicated, and the schemers creating this issue are creative. For investors to be aware of potential problem of STOLI and mitigate their downside risk by requiring insurers who have been defrauded at origination to return premiums at interest appears not to address the unique circumstances that gave rise to the issues. Accordingly, Commerce expresses no position related to the bill, but suggests that you consider the complexity of the transaction and the sophisticated parties that are advocating in front of you. From Commerce's vantage point, we are concerned about the long-term precedent this legislation may create and suggest courts are often better able to balance the rights and obligations of the parties, especially the sophisticated parties, by considering the unique circumstances that gave rise to the dispute and making a judgment. With that, we would be happy to answer any questions of the committee members.
Questions from members?
Thank
All
you,
right.
Madam Chair.
Seeing none, with that, the chair lays over House File. What number is it?
1031. As amended.
As amended. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The final bill before the committee, Representative Cornish. Representative Cornish moves that House File 1226 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Cornish.
Well, Madam Chair and members, if it's okay with you, I'll just give the testimony and save Mr. Kingery here for cleanup or if I stumble or whatever.
Well, Representative Cornish, I remember that you were asked a question about whether anyone else should be a part of this bill by Representative Kamer and his committee. So have you had a conversation about that, Representative Cornish?
Madam Chair, and we've had no one approach us to be included in, and judges or attorneys, as far as I know.
All right. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and members, what this bill is, House File 1226, it's been through public safety and it came here. It was presented last year and it winged through the committees, went onto the House floor. It passed the House floor last year with one no vote, Representative Rupavina, because he doesn't like anything that increases penalties. But otherwise, it was something like 130 to 1. And we met no opposition we know of. What it does is, House File 1226, it amends the statute 609.185, murder in the first degree. And you'll notice that there are two people in it already, peace officer or a guard employed at the local correctional facility, Minnesota State or local correctional facility. If you would assault or murder, there is an increased penalty. What this bill would do would be to include a prosecuting attorney. A prosecuting attorney would be defined as an attorney with criminal prosecution or civil responsibilities who worked in the U.S. District Attorney's Office, the Attorney General's Office, or a county or a city attorney's office. We did have somebody ask us a question why judges weren't included. The judges have never asked, and the reason I think the prosecuting attorneys, or he or she, are the one in the front line and do the most of the confrontation, where the judge is more of a fact finder. And this was brought to us by the County Attorneys Association, I believe. And that's House File 1226, just including a prosecuting attorney in the other two categories, a peace officer or correctional guard in first-degree murder.
Representative Moline.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I can wait till after the testimony, too.
I think he was just here to answer questions, so Representative Moline.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish, I guess I thought I had voted against this last year. I must have remembered incorrectly. But the reason for that, and you kind of answered it in your last statements, that I guess others haven't asked for this. And I just, you know, personally feel that when we specify certain professions where it's a higher degree to cause harm to those people, it's kind of making a statement that we value those people more than we value others. And I think that all life is valuable. And if you actually look at what's going on in our country right now, it seems like more teachers are killed on the job than prosecuting attorneys. But to my knowledge, we don't have anything in statute that has special penalties for someone if they kill a teacher. And, you know, my dad and brother are both cops, so I guess they get the special protections, too. But I still think we just have to be careful going forward, specifying certain professions that have extra protections when other people don't. So I guess mine was more of a comment than a question, but I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Moline. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And would this include not just the county attorney, but the deputy county attorneys and any attorneys that work for the county attorney?
Representative Cornish.
Yes.
Are there questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Members, the fiscal note came back. It's slightly incomplete. The Supreme Court hasn't responded yet, but sentencing guidelines came back with a zero. So at this point, Representative Cornish, I'm not going to hold it up for that, but if it comes back with a fiscal note, then we'll have to do something.
Re-refer.
Right.
Okay.
With that, Representative Cornish renews his motion that House File 1226 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Thank you.
And members, with that, this meeting is adjourned.
Good job.